Mr. Harry Brown is well known to, I believe, all of us. He's well known to investors around the world. In addition to his two best-selling investment books, Inflation Proofing Your Investments and How You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis, he is also the editor of two publications, Harry Brown's Special Reports and other reports that he puts out to investors. Mr. Brown has graciously come here today to spend about an hour and a half with all of us discussing various aspects of investments and different approaches to them. As Mr. Pugsley has mentioned, none of us can really be sure of what is going to take place tomorrow. Mr. Brown is here today to provide us with a framework in which we can best deal with the future and uncertainty. I'd like to welcome Mr. Harry Brown.
Well, it looks like that's all the time I have, so I want to thank you very much. I appreciate the introduction. Usually I am introduced as the largest coin dealer in Chicago, who happens to be Walter Pirsky, or I am the man who brought Elliott Wave to Australia, which is Bob McGregor, or something else. As a matter of fact, I was once introduced as the man who made $1 million in the gold market in London. And after standing up to this tumultuous ovation, I said there really are one or two misconceptions in the introduction that I should clear up before I go ahead with what I was going to say. In the first place, it wasn't the gold market, it was the silver market. And it wasn't London, it was Zurich. And it wasn't $1 million, it was, well, more like 100,000. And it wasn't me, it was my brother. And he didn't make it, he lost it. So it's kind of nice to get off on an even start. However, I was a little taken back by the fact that both the man who introduced me and the man who preceded me gave my speech for me and left me with almost nothing to say. And it's particularly bothersome because I had planned to spend an hour and a half saying all those things, and they found ways to say them in 5 minutes. But maybe I can fill up the time. What I would like to discuss during this time we have together is an approach for dealing with a world of uncertainty. And I'm going to do this in three or four parts. To begin with, I'd like to stress the uncertainty a little. We all know we live in an uncertain world, but I think that it's easy to forget that. When a very plausible view of the future comes along, it's very easy to believe that one does understand what's coming in the future. And then, after having emphasized the uncertainty, I would then like to get into a little more detail by discussing this issue that has come up several times during the seminar of the possibility of a deflation versus the possibility of renewed and perhaps even hyperinflation. And then to deal with a strategy both for the long term and the short term, a way of handling yourself and your investments in a world of uncertainty. So let's first begin by discussing that uncertainty a little. It is strange to me that you would never think of going to a fortune teller to find out which of the several possible marriage partners will be best for you, which one will give you a happy life and with whom you will be compatible over the years. You would never think of going to a fortune teller to see what kind of line of work you would get in or to see what kind of business would be most appropriate for you. You would perhaps, if you were at a party and there were a fortune teller there, you'd have your fortune told, but you wouldn't take it seriously. You wouldn't base any of your lifetime decisions on it. You wouldn't even base any short-term decisions on what the fortune teller said. But the strange thing is that when we start thinking about our investments, the first thing we do is look for a fortune teller. The first person we're trying to find is the fortune teller with a perfect record, the one who has been able to predict and call the top of every market, the bottom of every market, as if this were the key to investment success, when in fact we would give it no credence in any other area of our lives. But somehow the fortune teller rules. Economists spew out predictions every year for a 7.6% unemployment rate, an 8.2% inflation rate. Investment advisors talk about the target for gold, the prediction of when the silver market will bottom, what the Dow Jones average will be at the end of the year. All of these things are just parlor games. They add nothing to our lives. As a matter of fact, you could go through any market, such as the gold market, and look at the predictions. When they are made with very plausible explanations. At the time these predictions are given, or forecasts, views of the future, however they're labeled, they always have a plausible ring to them. I remember how, and this is so far back that I'm sure you won't remember, way, way back in 1980, we were told that the price of gold could not go below $600 because the central banks had so much tied up in gold, such a vested interest in gold because so large a part of their reserves, monetary reserves, were in gold, that they would support the price at $600 and never let it go below that. A very, very plausible explanation. When it didn't turn out that way, then we were told that they would, of course, support the price at $500 and at $450. And as a matter of fact, amazingly, just last week on the Reuters wire, I saw a report that a London gold dealer had resurrected this explanation to show why the price of gold is not likely to go below $350. And I realize that this is beating a very, very dead horse. That's 2 years ago that these explanations started, and they've been proven wrong. But it doesn't hurt to remember them when somebody gives you a very plausible reason why gold cannot go below 350 or 300 or 225 or 150 or $35, wherever it might be. We were told that the Russians had such a vested interest in gold market that they would manipulate the price by holding back sales to the West. The same thing is said about the South Africans, that they would hold back production for 2 or 3 months if necessary to hold up the price. We were also told, of course, a few years ago that the U.S. government would never let the price go over $500, that they would sell whatever gold was necessary to keep the price from going higher. None of these things worked out, but at the time they seemed to be plausible, real-world explanations of what was going on, explained in terms of the motivations of real human beings, and therefore had a ring of plausibility about them. We were told by authoritative technical experts that the price of gold was going to bottom at 388, and that that was indisputably and unalterably the bottom, and it could be shown with mathematical formulas and the Fibonacci numbers and the golden mean of 1.618 and on down the line. All very plausible, it just didn't happen to happen. The only prediction that's really left now, other than some that may have been made here that I haven't heard, but the only prediction that I've seen in print that is still alive is the one that gold is going to bottom between March and July at a price between 300 and 325. The reason for this is that its long-term trend line will be at that point during those months. And no one has explained why millions and millions of people around the world are watching that trend line and the price that changes every single day, the trend line is in a different position every day, are suddenly going to be motivated by some human action reason to step up their purchases at that price. But as long as it hasn't reached that point yet, then the prediction is still alive, and to some people it is very plausible. We must always remember that the fortune teller who has a perfect record up to now is going to go sour the day you start following his predictions and acting on them. You must never forget that. Everyone has a perfect record. I do, everyone else here, probably everyone in the audience has a perfect record up to this point. It just isn't going to work out so well tomorrow morning when we start acting on that advice. And, of course, the point is that in the real world, you don't need that kind of fortune-telling. Not in your business, not in your home life, and certainly not in the investment world. But you are told that this is the way to beat the markets. This is the way to get an edge on the rest of the world. This is the way to see into the future and buy what will be high next year and sell what is going lower next year. And, of course, even those people who are more modest than others will say, of course I'm not right all the time, but my record is better than average. I have one of the best records in the business. And the fact is that a better than average prediction record is not helpful in the least. It does not mean that you will come out ahead over a period of time. Just to give you one example, there were many, many people who bought silver at $30 or $40 because of the fact that some prominent forecasters had been so right about predicting back in the early 70s that silver was going up from $1.29 or $2 or wherever, and they had been proven right. These same forecasters who had once said silver was going to $20 were now saying that silver was going to $100. They had a better than average record, and so it was understandable that a lot of people did not sell at $30, and even other people bought at $30 based on the better than average prediction record of those advisors. The result, of course, is that most of those people are still holding their silver today, waiting for silver to go to $100 an ounce or more. I think silver may go to $100 an ounce. My projection is the year 2017. I have computed the annual interest rate of holding silver until then as something like 0.0003% per year. But the point is really not whether silver is going to $100, but whether one can survive by acting on the views of fortune tellers. I don't think so. I think that it is more important in your business life, in your home life, in your investment life, to have a philosophy that deals with life, a strategy for dealing with an unknown world, an uncertain world, a world that is so vast, so huge, that we could not possibly read the minds of all the human beings throughout the world that are going to affect the outcome of any given investment or any given business. It is said, of course, that one does not have to know what all these individuals are going to do, but rather one deals with economic laws and expects broad changes to take place as a result of those laws. But even there, even though I have been studying economics for years and years and years, even though I love the subject, even though I love the investment markets, which grow out of a study of economics, I have to realize that economics is not like physics. Economics is not a physical science. It is a social science. You cannot test economic theories in the way you can test physical theories. If you believe, for example, that you have developed a new electronic connection that will speed up the transfer of data within computers, you can go into a laboratory and you can test this. You can isolate the variables, the temperature, all of the other things, and check each variable individually until you are 99% sure that you have allowed for everything, every condition that might exist when that electronic connection goes out into the world to perform its service. You can't ever be absolutely sure because you may have overlooked the fact that there is a variable that existed in that laboratory that would not exist out in the computer in Des Moines, Iowa or someplace else, but you can be almost sure. We can't do that with economics. Economics cannot be developed inductively. It has to be developed deductively, meaning that we develop economic theories by thinking about the way the world works, the way human beings work, the way human beings make their decisions. And from this, we follow step by step through this market, through that market, through these actions, and so on, until we come to conclusions where we say such things as if the supply of money is increased, then prices will have to be higher than they would have been without the increase in the supply of money. But we never have the chance to test it. You can look back through history and you can find example after example of where this theory apparently has been in action. But the fact is, every one of the situations were different. Every one of all the other variables had a different complexion in each of the tests that we apply to it. Now, that doesn't mean we're helpless. That doesn't mean that we can't possibly know anything about economics. It means that we should have more skepticism. When we turn on the television set, there is no reason to be skeptical that it as to whether it's going the picture is going to come on the screen or it's going to stay blank. One day the screen may be blank, and then we call a repairman because he knows why the screen went blank, and he does something to change it and make it work. But generally speaking, we just simply turn on the set and know that the picture is going to come on. With economics, we can't do that. We can't simply say we know that this is true and therefore this is going to follow. We may even be right in the theory, but we can't be sure that all of the conditions that exist next year or the year after will be the conditions that we're feeding into our mental application of the theory. We just cannot know. But we are not helpless. We use those theories, we use that philosophy, and more than anything else, we use a strategy that allows us to go with what we expect, to place bets on what we expect, to make investments based on what we expect, but ready to bail out or to change direction when what we expected proves not to be the case. Predictions don't allow for that. Predictions encourage you to place an all or nothing bet on one outcome. And as a result, the losses are greater when the prediction doesn't turn out, and the gains are not necessarily any greater when they do. The gold market is a good example. There are people who perhaps predicted the $103 bottom in gold before August of 1976. There are people perhaps who predicted the top of the gold market in January of 1980 at $850. Out of all the many, many, many predictions that are made about every investment market, it is almost certain that somebody is going to be right. Someone wins a lottery, so someone is going to have to win the prediction lottery, either by hitting it on the nose or coming within a dollar or at least coming much, much closer than anyone else does. And yet, that was not the key to making money in the gold market, because unfortunately, the one who predicted the $103 bottom correctly was not the same one who predicted the $850 top correctly. And so not only would you have had to act on the right predictor at the beginning, you would have had to switch predictors somewhere in the middle and get a better one at the end so that you could come out ahead at that end too. On the other hand, mere strategy was capable of making big profits in the gold market during that period, simply because gold bull markets up to now have been so big, so vast, of such long duration and of such great magnitude in terms of their price changes that it was possible to get in well after the bottom and get out either well before or well after the top and still show a very healthy profit. In my own case, and I do not hold this up as an example of great timing or great acumen. If anything, it is a simple application of strategy. We got into the bull market in January of 1978 at $162, which was 55% above the bottom. 55% above the bottom. My God, you must have missed almost all of it. And we got out at $600 2 months and 30% after the top. And the net result was a 26-month gain of 275%. Or even if you spread that out over 5 years, meaning 3 years of doing nothing, waiting for this time to go ahead and buy when it appeared to be safe and then getting out, but over the 5 years from top of one bull market to the top of the next, you still had a return, an annual, compounded annual return of 30% on your money without any specialized timing whatsoever. It was simply a case of waiting until it was obvious that the bull market was underway, taking a position and being ready to bail out. Bail out by having a stop loss at a place that you consider to be appropriate. As the price rose, raising that stop loss, as it cleared various hurdles along the way that it had to go to wherever it was going, then moving the stop loss to under that hurdle, because the hurdle now also gave it a little support behind it, and continually moving it up. Eventually, the price moved so fast at the end that the stop loss did not seem appropriate at anything higher than $600, and there was that huge drop in 2 months, and we got stopped out. We got stopped out when the bull market was over. And we were a long, long way from the top. And yet, as modest as that seems, to get in 55% over the bottom and 30% and get out 30% below the top, every single night, before I go to bed, I say my mantra, I arrange my beads on the windowsill in just the right shape, and I get down on my knees and I pray for another bull market like that. Another bull market that was so vast, so broad, and of such a magnitude that it was easy to get in and easy to get out without having any explicit timing indicators to guide one. Because those timing indicators, unfortunately, just like the perfect fortune teller, will go sour the moment you start using them. Technical analysis can help. And I certainly believe that technical analysis is necessary along with fundamental analysis in order to help one decide when is the best time to get in, such as how far does the bull market have to go before you'll believe it? How far does the price have to drop before you'll believe the bull market is over? But the problem is that technical analysis has been perverted and turned into a fortune-telling device by the creation of all kinds of patterns and so on the chart. And this takes technical analysis into an area that it cannot possibly help us. The significance, the importance of technical analysis is in telling you the significance of what has happened. It tells you that if a price has dropped through a support level, that you should take that price drop very seriously. But technical analysis can't tell you what will happen. It can't tell you if it will drop, the price will drop through the support level, nor can it tell you how far it will drop after it does so, if it does drop through the support level. Its value is in telling you the significance of what has happened, not in telling you what will happen. And attempts to make it tell you what will happen are no more fruitful than any other kind of fortune-telling devices. Now, I realize that people will tell you, I don't know why it works, I can't explain it, I can't give you a theory that explains why trend lines and reverse head and shoulders patterns and pennants, et cetera, do what they do, and Fibonacci numbers. All I can tell you that it is that it works, and it happens too often to be coincidence. But the truth is that it doesn't happen that often at all. Anybody who believes in any mystical science, if science is the proper word, will always believe that it is working, will always tell you that despite the little pitfalls here and the drawbacks there, that it works. And when in fact it doesn't work that often, and when it does happen, it is coincidence. There are many, many coincidences in this world. All right, if I believe then that we have no signposts to say that next year this is going to happen, the year after that is going to happen, and here is where you buy at the bottom and there is where you sell at the top, how do you deal with this? Well, I think that in my view, one needs to, first of all, separate what he is doing, categorize it, label it, and define it for what it is. You hear a great deal of advice that says, I think this is good right now. And of course, somebody comes up to me and says, what do you think of copper right now? Or what do you think of gold? And the question is kind of hanging out in the air. Of course, if somebody comes up to me and says, what do you think the gold price is going to do? That's a specific question. And I can say, I don't know, let me look at your palm and I'll tell you. But when somebody just comes up and says, do you think copper is a good investment? Or do you think lumber is a good investment? Or what do you think about silver right now? This isn't a question because there is no context for it. There might be 100 answers to that question. What do I think about copper in regard to what? To accomplish what? To serve what purpose? As an investment? If an investment, in what way? What are you talking about? Are you saying, should you buy copper tomorrow morning at the opening and be prepared to sell out at the end of the week with a 10% gain? Or are you talking about copper over the next year? Or does it fit into a balanced portfolio? And so the point is that one must first define what it is he is doing, what kinds of investments he is looking for, and for what purpose. What is the point of buying copper? Is it as a speculation to make money over the next year? Is it to balance some contrary investment in your portfolio for which you think you are overly invested? What is the purpose? And I think it helps as a start in this definition process to separate your net worth, the funds that you have available, the wealth that is yours at this moment. I think it is valuable to separate this into two portfolios. For want of better labels, I call them the permanent portfolio and the variable portfolio. The permanent portfolio is constructed on somewhat of a 10-year time frame, the idea being that I am setting up investments that I do not intend to tinker with over the next 10 years. And I am setting up this portfolio with the objective of coming out ahead no matter what the future holds during that 10-year period. Then I have a second portfolio called the variable portfolio, whose purpose is to take advantage of what I believe are the short-term trends. If I think gold is currently in a bear market, I am not going to sell the gold from the permanent portfolio, because it is there for more than just immediate price appreciation. It is there perhaps to balance out all the other investments in the portfolio, some of which are doing perhaps very well simply because gold is in a bear market, and overall they're coming out ahead. But with the variable portfolio, if I think gold is in a bear market, I would, with those funds, either be staying out of the gold market or I would be selling gold short if I'm inclined towards those kinds of investments. With the variable portfolio, I do not feel that I need to be in every bull market. In fact, far from it. But I do try to take advantage of what I believe are the near-term trends. For example, in January of 78, I got into gold, and I got out of gold in 1980. Other investments have been made since then, and I will come back to the variable portfolio a little bit later, because I have some very definite views about the strategy to use with those short-term funds in the variable portfolio for the next year or so, and I want to emphasize them strongly. But first, let me return to the permanent portfolio for a minute. In the workshop with Terry Coxon, described how one goes about setting up a permanent portfolio and what the purpose is. And I'm not going to repeat that now, because at least 10 people here were in that workshop, and I don't want to bore them. My intention is to bore all of you. And so I'm not going to go over all of that ground again, but what I would like to do is to set the context for the rest of what I want to cover, to just hit the highlights quickly. A permanent portfolio's main objective, I believe, in terms of composition, is balance. To find those investments that balance and complement each other so well that no matter what the future holds, I should come out ahead, or at the very worst, break even. And the very worst being if everything that I expect turns out to be the opposite. Now, there are many, many things that affect investments, many social, political, economic factors that affect investments, but today the dominating interest is inflation. Inflation dominates our economic attention, and it certainly tends to dominate the investment markets. And there are really five all-inclusive possibilities for inflation over the next 10 years. One, that it'll level off at some constant rate, like 10%. One, that it'll continue rising in waves as it has over the last 20 years. One, that it'll accelerate that rise and go into a runaway inflation, perhaps leading to complete worthlessness of the currency. The fourth possibility is that the government will be successful in easing down inflation slowly over a period of years until it glides down and lands softly at zero. And the fifth is that the bottom will fall out and we will have a deflation. Most people do not expect inflation to level off. Most people who spend time with their investments and have given thought to economics, because there are a lot of economic reasons why inflation at this advanced stage is not likely to stand still. It's either going to go down or up, but not level off. Many people do not give credence to the soft landing, the basically monetarist approach that if you just reduce the money supply gradually, that inflation can be eased down to zero without great traumas. Most people feel that what we're going to have is a continuation of rising inflation, such as we've had over the 20 years with a rising rate and then a fall back a little ways, but not back to where it started, rise to a higher rate and so on going over many years, or that this is going to erupt into a runaway inflation. A few people believe that there could be a deflation, that the bottom could fall out. Now, my personal view is that the most likely possibility for the next 10 years is that we will either have a continuation of rising inflation or we will have a deflation. I am not ruling out an ultimate runaway inflation, but I am somewhat ruling it out for the next 10 years, in that I believe that we are too far from the runaway stage. A runaway inflation does not develop overnight. It builds up over a period of time, a great period of time. unless the monetary authorities in the country are just completely insane, which sometimes happens in banana republics where a new government comes in and inflation goes from 7% to 100% within 2 years. But that is not likely in the United States. But I do not rule it out eventually. It's just that my immediate concern now is the next 10 years. I am more concerned that the bottom may fall out this year or next year or sometime within the next couple of years, and if not then maybe 6 or 7 years down the line during the next credit crunch, or the possibility that inflation will continue to rise. But with what I have said up to now, I would certainly be foolish to say that I would rule out any of the other three possibilities. So what I want is a long-term portfolio that perhaps places a little emphasis on my expectations. Because if my expectations prove to be correct, I do not want to look back and say, I felt this coming and I didn't do anything to take advantage of it. I could have gained if I had had more nerve and was willing to place some bets in this direction. But at the same time, I can be wrong. We may have that soft landing, which is going to create a completely different environment in which the investments I expected to do badly will do very well, and the investments I expected to do very well will do badly. I either said the same thing twice or I said it right, but you know what I mean. Anywhere along here that I say something that's not understandable, you know what I mean. In any event, what I need is a portfolio that will protect me in all five of these circumstances, but give me the most profit if my expectations turn out to be correct. Now, that doesn't seem possible at first glance, because we tend to think of balance and hedging as an immobilizing process, meaning you go long on gold and you go short on gold, or you go long on gold and you go long on something else that is the opposite of gold, and they just immobilize each other. So no matter what happens, you come out even. But it doesn't work that way, and the main reason it doesn't work that way is because we're dealing with a 10-year time frame. The price of gold right now is around $350. I don't know what the price of gold will be 10 years from now. I have no idea. But one thing I'm fairly sure of is that the price of gold 10 years from today is not likely to be $350. It could be $35 or $60. It could be $3,000, but it is not going to be $350. I could be wrong about that, but that's one investment. And out of the 10 investments or 8 investments that I may put in a portfolio, the chances of very many of those investments being at the same price 10 years from today that they are today is so remote as to be worth assuming that it will not be the case, and building a strategy around it. Now, this creates long-term leverage. Leverage not in the sense of margin buying, but leverage in the sense that an investment can produce a result in your portfolio out of proportion to the amount you have allocated to it. And I will wrap up this discussion of the permanent portfolio with an example that I'm going to repeat from the workshop simply because I've never come up with a better one. Suppose you had $100 in this permanent portfolio and you put $50 of it in gold today and $50 in long-term treasury bonds. For U.S. citizens, that would be U.S. treasury bonds. For citizens and residents of other countries who think in other currencies, it would be long-term bonds, the longest available of the government of the country in which they live. Now, suppose inflation continues to rise, and 10 years from now, inflation is at 35% or 40%. We can be pretty sure that interest rates are going to be up around 30 or 40%, if not higher, and the result will be that those long-term bonds will be relatively worthless. The $50 we put in bonds may be worth, in terms of nominal dollars, $2 or $3, even though we're 10 years closer to maturity. In real purchasing power terms, in 1982 dollars, they're going to be worth about 20 cents out of the $50 that we put into them. In other words, they're a virtual write-off. They have gone to zero. But the fact is they can't go below zero, meaning you cannot lose more than the $50 you invested in them. Meanwhile, the price of gold under those circumstances, we assume, would be somewhere in what we would today consider to be stratospheric levels, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 an ounce, as a result of this 10 years of inflation rising up to 35%. The result would be, in real purchasing power terms, that the value of that gold, in real after inflation terms, had tripled, quadrupled, quintupled, I don't know what, but it would have been a strong rise because gold outpaces the rate of inflation, certainly has up to now. The result would be that in 1982 dollars, in real dollar terms, that portfolio that started with $100 would be worth maybe $200, maybe $150, but it would be worth something greater than $100. Now, of course, why don't we just throw out the bonds and put the whole $100 in gold, and that way the portfolio might be worth $500 10 years from now instead of just $150 or $200. And the reason is because we can't be sure that inflation is going to go to 35 or 40%. And if it doesn't, if the opposite happens, if we get the soft landing or if we get the bottom falling out and a deflation, then we have a different situation. The gold probably, over a period of time, would tend to fall, even if there were a sharp spike up during the initial stages of a deflation just because of the anxiety and uncertainty that it produced. But over the long term, we could expect that gold would fall, and maybe the value of that gold in 1982 dollars at that point would be only $10 or $15 out of the 50 that we put into it, maybe even five. I don't know. It isn't important. But interest rates would have dropped so much from the present level of around 14% on those long-term bonds to a level of 1, 2, 3%. They were 1% at the bottom of the 1930s deflation, and that is not a precedent, but it is an illustration of the magnitude of change that could take place. The result would be that in 1982 dollars, those bonds that we put $50 into would be worth $150 or $200. And when we add the $10 or $15 that's left of the gold, we would again have a doubling of the portfolio in real purchasing power terms. So that whichever way it goes, we've come out ahead. The reason is that whichever way it goes, one of those investments is going to have a considerably higher price. Not just a higher price, but a considerably higher price than where we started, while the other investment can do no worse than go to zero. And this is what I mean by leverage. Now, the example I've given is oversimplified because it includes a lot of assumptions about what would happen to the gold price in inflation, what would happen to bonds in deflation, and so on, which may prove not to be the case. And for that reason, I would not want to build a portfolio just half in bonds and half in gold. I would want to include such things as highly leveraged stocks, which can't go to zero, but would go up many, many times their initial value if we had the soft landing and we had an outbreak of prosperity. I would want to have other things just for diversification, just to protect against the assumptions that I'm making. Other things that might do well, say, in inflation, if gold turns out to go separate from inflation, and that this relationship, which seems so fixed today between inflation and gold, turns out to go past a fork in the road because we were overlooking a variable that was affecting both inflation and gold and now was doing something different so that they didn't go in the same direction in the future. So I might have what I think is the strongest foreign currency, Swiss francs, in that portfolio. I might have silver because silver profits and loses in different situations from gold. Gold is primarily a monetary metal. The industrial consumption of gold is infinitesimal compared to the existing supply available to the market every day. But silver is primarily an industrial metal. The monetary use of gold is insignificant, and the existing supply is nothing like the existing supply of gold. Therefore, silver is more likely to do well in a soft landing than gold is, and silver is less likely to do well in extreme inflation, such as 30 or 40%, let alone runaway inflation, because the industrial use of silver would break down while the monetary use of gold would go up. I see them as different investments serving a different purpose. So what I want to do is create a collection of these. When I do so, I will weight them in the direction that I think the future is most likely to go. But it isn't even necessary to do that to have an opinion. You can just simply take an uncertain view, a neutral view, and weight them so that it will do well whatever happens. If everything turns out as I expected, I should have a doubling or tripling of the purchasing power over a 10-year period. If things only partially work out that way, then maybe a 50 to 100% gain in purchasing power. And if everything goes the opposite of what I expected, I hope to break even or perhaps at worst wind up with a 10% loss in purchasing power. Now, this is easier said than done. It takes a lot of work to create that portfolio, and the article in the course book is designed to help you do that, to go through the process of doing it, and not only creating it, but analyzing it afterward to see if you are protecting yourself as you thought you were by making some assumptions about how investments would do in various economic conditions. But always remember that those assumptions in the article are just assumptions. They are not facts. They are not a firm foundation upon which to build. They are just the only foundation we have to build on. So for that reason, feel free to change the assumptions. But just don't get carried away. There is a comparison there with how a go-for-broke portfolio, one all in gold or all in real estate, would do compared to a balanced portfolio in the various conditions. And with that, I will leave you to look at that article on the plane on the way home or 2 weeks after you get home. But just with the thought that this is not an easy task, but it is a one-time task. You do it, you spend several days on it, and you get it right, and then you should truly be able to walk away from your investments if you want to, if you choose not to also have a variable portfolio. Now, I would like, because of the attention that's been given to this question of inflation and deflation, I would like, before discussing the variable portfolio, I'd like to discuss the possibility of a deflation. I said that there were certain things, certain of the five scenarios for inflation that seemed less than likely to me, and I said also that deflation seemed to me one of the strongest possibilities at the moment. The general tone of speakers here was that inflation is the most likely scenario, and that while a deflation could happen because of an accident or something, it was not very likely, and one could afford to bet against it. The fact that I'm taking the deflation side and there are so many that are taking the inflation does not the supply of money will not drop. The Fed will not let the supply go down. They will do whatever they have to keep the supply rising to ward off the deflation. But what about the demand? Ludwig von Mises, way back in 1912, defined inflation very simply as you would define the fundamental value of anything in the world. He said that inflation is caused when the supply of money rises faster than the demand for it. And of course, it would also be true that inflation would be caused if the demand for money dropped faster than the supply dropped. The result is that the thing, the dollar bill, the money, is no longer as valuable as it was before because the supply is outrunning the demand of it, for it. And the result is that the money becomes less valuable, and therefore, when you trade it for something else, you get fewer of those other things in exchange for it. Conversely, a deflation results when the demand for money rises faster than the supply of it. The result is that the thing, the money, becomes more valuable, and as a result, people will give you more of other things in exchange for the money, and the result is what we think of as falling prices, because $1 will then exchange for more corn than it could before. Also, as its corollary, a deflation would result if the supply of money, if the supply of money were rising. Now I've forgotten what I said before. Let me start again. The two sides of the same thing. A deflation results if the demand for money rises faster than the supply. It would also result if the supply of money were falling faster than the demand. But what I'm going to focus on here is a rise in the demand for money that is greater than the increase in the supply of money, making the money more valuable, making prices that we look at on the shelves lower. Now, what is the demand for money and what is the money we're talking about? And this is a whole subject of its own. But simply for the purposes of this discussion, I will refer to money as pieces of paper that we keep in our pocket called dollar bills, dollars that are on deposit in banks, savings, loans, any place else that are withdrawable on demand. In other words, money that is immediately available for spending. This includes treasury bills, commercial paper, time deposits, and so on, because those things are either not spendable at the moment, or they must first be exchanged for money before they can be spent on something else. Now, let me make it clear about the definition. There are a host of definitions of what money is, and the reason you define something is not to hold it up on a pillar and say, this is it for all time. You define it so that people know what you're talking about when you use the word in further discussion. And I am defining money because it will make it clearest what's going on when I go on with this scenario. It is not meant to be ideological either. I'm not saying this is the best money that could exist in the world. I'm simply saying this is the money that we are using today as purchasing medium. Now, the demand for money is the desire to hold this cash, either in the form of a checking account that one can put his hands on immediately, or in his pocket in the form of banknotes, or buried in the basement or under the mattress or wherever. It is the desire to have the ultimate liquidity, the ultimate spendable money. And every individual makes a choice all the time, consciously or unconsciously, about how much of his wealth he wants to hold in the form of money. The demand for money rises or falls as individuals collectively change their opinions about how much money they want to hold. Five people want to hold more, two people want to hold less, and the result is a general rise in the demand for money. But it's not a mathematical equation, of course, it's just an illustration. The point is that the collective demand for money rises or falls as people are more anxious or less anxious to hold money rather than something else, like stocks or cars or real estate or whatever it may be. Now, the demand for money has been dropping steadily since the Second World War. It has been dropping for two basic reasons, although there are bound to be many others that have affected it. The first is that the demand for money was at a very, very high level during the Second World War, first as an aftermath of the Depression, and second because of the uncertainty created by the war. In other words, during that period, people wanted to hold more money than they normally would because they were very insecure about the future. As conditions got better and better, the demand for money dropped, starting with the end of the Second World War and just leading slowly but surely right up to the present. This drop in the demand for money accelerated somewhat because of inflation, an inflation that was triggered mostly by rises in the supply of money. As a result of these rises in the supply that were being matched with a fall in demand, the money, of course, was becoming worth less and less, very slowly at first. And usually during the first stages of an inflation, the demand for money rises because individuals say, I'm not going to buy a refrigerator today. They just raised the price 5%. I'll wait until next year until the price comes back down again, and then I'll buy it at a better price. But if inflation continues over a period of time, sooner or later individuals realize that the price isn't coming down next year, and so they not only don't wait until next year to buy, they actually speed up their purchases in order to buy ahead of the need and ahead of the price increase. And this, of course, creates a fall in the demand for money. They would rather be holding the refrigerator than the money. And so individuals want less and less of the money. And this trend has just continued now for 37 years or so, just a steady fall in the demand to hold U.S. dollars. Now, as inflation has picked up, individuals have begun to realize that holding dollars is expensive. Now, they might look at it in the terms of, gee, if I hold these dollars, I can buy less with them next year. Or they may look at it from the standpoint, if I hold these dollars just as dollars in my pocket or in a checking account, I'm losing interest that I see advertised in the paper. People are telling me I can get 5% interest, or later 7%, or 12%, or 15%. So individuals look for ways to hold dollars, to have a dollar asset, but not to hold it as money, but rather to hold it as what we can call a money substitute or a cash substitute. And these things would be basically interest-bearing investments in dollars, like treasury bills, commercial paper, bankers' acceptances, time deposits, and so on. As time goes on, people come into the market to fill a need and offer a service that didn't exist before. And so today we have money market funds, which are not additional cash substitutes. They are just intermediaries intermediaries in the cash substitute market, making it possible for somebody to invest easily in $100,000 treasury bills or $100,000 lots of commercial paper. They are just an intermediary between the cash substitute market and the individual. So what we have today then is a further decrease in the demand for money, because now it has become easier to hold what is like money but without having to hold the deteriorating money itself. So the existence of these cash substitute markets, some of which didn't exist 20 or 25 years ago or were so small as to be unnoticeable, plus the money market funds, have further provided an impetus to the decline in the demand for money. Now, the whole question of deflation, as I see it, hinges on one point. That is, could something happen that would change this pattern and cause the demand for money to rise rather than fall, and to rise faster than increases of the supply of money, which would create the opposite of what we've had before, which would create a deflation where prices would drop and we would take on the general environment that we had in the 1930s. I believe it could. I believe that the demand for money could rise even as you and I stand here or sit here and say these dollars are going to be worth less next year. Haven't you at any time in the last 10 years said, I do not want to spend any money right now. I want to hold back and in fact increase my cash balance, even though I know the money is going to be worth less next year. Of course, almost everyone has, and not because he didn't understand inflation, but simply because he had a personal need to increase his cash balance and provide a little more security than he had. Now, those things tend to cancel each other out in the market. You increase your cash balance, you decrease yours, and maybe he decreases his too, and so the result is a collective fall in the demand for money. But if an event occurred that caused most people to want to increase their cash balances, even as they saw deteriorating money down the road, then what you would have is a rise in the demand for money. And the cash substitute market is one significant, but not the only area, where such an event could take place. There isn't anyone in this room who doesn't realize that corporations, banks, and even local state government agencies are having financial problems. People invest in cash substitutes not as a speculation, but as what they consider to be a secure way of earning interest while holding something very much like money, something close to money. And they do so not because they think they can outguess the market, not because they think General Motors is a stronger company than other people think it is, and therefore its stock will go up, but simply because they assume that everyone who issues commercial paper, every bank that offers a time deposit, every government that offers a treasury bill, whatever it may be, is going to make good on it. And the only question is, what is the interest rate? Sure, there is a risk, but the risk is 1 in 1,000, and it is not an important factor in the decision. But yet, as I said, we all realize that corporations are in trouble in general. We all realize that banks are in trouble in general. What happens if some large corporation with a high rating, like Penn Central or W.T. Grant or any of the others that have in fact gone down in the last 10 years, companies like that today that enjoy the same kinds of reputations, what if one of them pays off its commercial paper, but only after, pays off the paper on the due date, but only after, say, a few weeks of uncertainty in the market about whether it would be capable of doing so? The chances are the market will skip a beat, hesitate a little, and then go on as it was. But then when the second one does, what happens then? Well, the market may do more than skip a beat the second time. The market may, in fact, discount that commercial paper, make it available at less than the equivalent of its par value, taking the time factor into consideration, time factor to maturity. And the third time it happens, the commercial paper market may be in shambles. And it can go in shambles simply because nobody is in the commercial paper market to speculate on the future of companies. Nobody is there speculating on which ones will pay off and which ones won't. They are there only because they all pay off, and there is no question about it. And the moment one large company fails to do so, there is going to be a movement out of commercial paper. How big, how small, I can't say. But given a group of them, it's almost certain that it will be a mass movement that would drive discounts on commercial paper to 40% or more, where it would then be a market for speculators, wondering which company is going to pay off its commercial paper. What if one large company fails to pay its time deposits? Time deposits, many of which will be over $100,000 because they will be to corporations or money market funds, and therefore the overage won't be covered by Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation blanket. What happens when that occurs? What happens if a large bank that supposedly was liquid by official standards but had pledged all its liquidity in order to get trust accounts from governments and other places suddenly finds out it does not have enough liquidity to pay out its customers? What happens if that bank continues to pay out its deposits to its customers, but only because the Federal Reserve had to lend it $1.5 billion to do so? Is that going to allow for continued confidence in the time deposits of that company? What can happen is a series of events like this, which will not be an accident, and it is a mistake to refer to it as some accident that may tip it all off. It will not be an accident. It will be the inevitable result of 20 years of inflation. When that happens, when something like this happens, there will be a movement out of cash substitutes and into cash. The demand for money will rise, and then it will be up to the Fed not to prevent a fall in the supply of money, but to keep the supply of money rising fast enough to keep up with the demand. And there are a few problems with that. It is easy to say, look, they are not going to let the country go under. They are going to do whatever they have to stop the banks from failing. They'll lend them $8 trillion if they have to stop the banks from failing. They're not going to let General Motors go under because they know what that would mean. They are not going to allow it to happen. But there are a few problems with that, a few problems with assuming they are not going to let it happen. The first place, they don't even know what is happening. Who in this room right now knows what the demand for money is today? Probably of all the people in this room, there are 10 or 12, if I asked, and I'm not going to, who could raise their hands and tell me what the U.S. money supply was last week within $1 billion or so. There isn't one person in this room, myself included, who knows what the demand for money is today. The supply is measurable because it exists in various forms that can be counted. The demand for money is up here. We can only see what it has been in retrospect by working backward through numbers and saying, as a result, the demand for money must have been this year compared to this and this year. And we don't really measure the demand for money. We measure changes in the demand for money on a very abstract basis, like the Consumer Price Index does not tell you how much everything costs today. It only tells you, in general, how much things cost compared to what they were last month or last year. No one knows what the demand for money is, including those seven guys or the 12 that sit at the Federal Open Market Committee meetings or the seven that sit on the Federal Reserve Board meetings. They don't know what the demand for money is either. So in the first place, they can't even measure how much the demand is rising and try to offset it with increases in the supply. Second, by now, there isn't hardly an individual in the United States of America who believes that the Fed can make the supply of money be what it wants to be. And we've even seen arguments here over what the Fed should be doing, how they should be changing to another system of regulating the money supply from the one they have now. This perfect wisdom today is anything but perfect. What they've learned from the past 50 years is anything but sure knowledge. They are still groping around in the dark trying to decide how to increase the money supply to get back on target or how to lower it to get back below the upper reach of it. They are still groping in the dark. Third, what makes you think that they are going to rescue the first company or bank that goes under? The Fed changed its policy in October 79, and I, like 100 million other Americans when they said, from now on, we're not going to chase interest rates, we're going to regulate the supply of money, and we're going to ease it down gradually over the years and bring inflation to a slow but sure halt. I, like everybody else, said, ha, 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 ha. That's exactly what I said. Ha, 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 ha. Or was it tee-hee? Well, it was one or the other. In any event, I laughed like everybody else did when they sat down to play. But over 2 years later, almost 2.5 years later, as imperfectly as they're going about it, as crudely, as awkwardly, they have not wavered from this approach. In October of last year, when interest rates fell, the prevailing wisdom was the Fed caved in, they threw in the towel, unemployment got too high, and in fact, there was no evidence that the Fed had changed direction at all. All that had happened was that interest rates came down. And if the Fed kept the money supply at 0% for the next 10 years, you'd think that interest rates would be at 15 or 20%. No, you would think they would be at 1 or 2 or 3%. Interest rates have to come down eventually if the Fed holds on long enough. But that's not the point. The point is, after 2.5 years, for the first time in post-war history, the Fed has finally made it stick for this long. A five-year policy has finally lasted 2.5 years instead of 2.5 days or 2.5 weeks. They have come so far. Do you think that everybody on that open market committee that decides what to do with the bank reserves every week is going to say at the first sign of trouble, oh, sure, let's throw in the policy. Let's forget about it. Let's let inflation go back up to 15 or 20% because we don't want the Third National Bank of Miami, Florida to fail, or even the Bank of America to fail. They will try to take other means to save the Bank of America or Citicorp or whoever it happens to be, and I'm only throwing names around. The point is that it is always easy to see in retrospect. Take any investment price chart. The bottom of gold was 103. Why didn't I buy then? It's so obvious. The top was 850. Why did I hang on and let them tell me it was going to 1,000? Why didn't I at least sell when it got down to 700 or 600 or 500? Couldn't I see what was happening? The answer is no, I couldn't see what was happening because that chart didn't exist then. It only exists today. At that particular time, at say $600 gold, the drop in the price of gold looked no differently on the chart from other drops that had taken place that then caused resumptions of the uptrend afterward. Why would I sell out when this would turn out to be an uptrend? Why would the Fed reinflate suddenly when it may turn out to be a simple aberration in the general course of things, when it may be an isolated failure? In retrospect, 10 years from now, you may wonder why the Fed didn't do this or didn't do that, just as everybody keeps saying today, why didn't they do it in the 30s? Because at the time, the perspective, the knowledge, the understanding, the direction was not visible. And it isn't going to be visible in 1982 any more than it was then. The question is not of the Fed deliberately deflating the money supply. It is a question of whether the Fed will inflate the money supply fast enough to keep up with a rise in the demand for money, if that rise takes place. Now, I am just really scratching the surface of this subject. In Inflation-Proofing Your Investments, the book that Terry Cox and I published last year, we have one chapter that is devoted entirely to a long event-by-event scenario of how this might take place, finally culminating at the darkest days with the summit meeting at Camp David, to which the president invites Martin Luther King Sr., Ralph Nader, Sheikh Absouf, Richard Nixon, and a few others, and then has a fireside chat and explains to the nation that the worst is over. And thank God, even though prices are down 30% and the Dow Jones is at 150, the government has the tools today to prevent a depression such as that which took place in the 1930s. And this, of course, this scenario that is described there is not a prediction either. All we are trying to do is to make you aware that it could happen, that it is conceivable, and that one-liners do not explain the economics of the world. The Fed won't let it happen is not an investment strategy. It is not a pearl of wisdom. It is simply a summation of somebody's opinion with no explanation of how they will prevent it from happening. The Fed may well prevent it from happening. Certainly the Fed will not want it to happen, and I agree with all that. But the chance of it happening is too great for me to ignore when I sit down and plan that long-term portfolio. I want long-term bonds in there, which would offset a lot of losses in gold and stocks and other investments in that balanced portfolio. I want short-term dollars in there in the form of treasury bills, and I want them to be in treasury bills, not commercial paper or something else which would be affected adversely by the very thing that eventually drives interest rates down and makes dollar investments so much more valuable than they are today. And so those things, to me, have to be in there, even as I recognize that runaway inflation exists. If we had another 3 days and 2 hours for me to stand up here and bore you to death, I'd give you a scenario on runaway inflation. And then if we had another week after that, I'd give you a scenario on how a soft landing could actually take place, even though that's not one of my prime possibilities. These things can happen, and we do not know which of them is going to happen. We do not we could not possibly have the knowledge to make those decisions. I am agnostic by this, but I am not, I'm agnostic about this, but I am not a know-nothing. I know that I have coped with my life for all of these 26 years since I was born. I know that I have been able to deal with uncertainty in the past, and I know that I can deal with it in the future. And I do know that I will deal with it not by attempting to read the future, but by having a philosophy, a strategy that enables me to go with my assumptions, to act on my expectations, but be prepared to abandon them when greater knowledge is available tomorrow and next week and next year, and shows that my expectations may have been well-founded, but did not turn out, in fact, to be the case. Now, finally, let's turn from that then to the variable portfolio, what I call the variable portfolio, and short-term investments, and what I think are the opportunities today. I think that today, in early 1982, we have one of the greatest opportunities that has existed in the last 20 years in the investment markets. It is the opportunity to do nothing. I am so afraid of the investment markets right now that I am not going to poke my head out the door for any but the most overwhelming opportunity that presents itself. I believe we have passed out of the era of the 70s, not just chronologically, but in terms of environment. I think that we are definitely in a different environment. The hard money era is over, which does not mean gold and silver and foreign currencies will not rise again, or that we will not make money in them again at some point in the future. But we certainly are not going to rely on all of the patterns of the 1970s simply repeating themselves. The monetary cycles on which so many of us based our gold decisions, that is, these alternating waves of Fed tight money and loose money, have broken down. Those cycles have broken down so much, their definitions have been so blurred, that they are no longer a key to investment strategy, to timing strategy for when to be in stocks. Gold has been a bear market for 2 years. Where is the stock bull market that usually accompanies a gold bear market? Where is the bond bull market that we saw in 75 and 76? There may yet be a bull market in either of these things starting tomorrow morning, but it's a long, long time coming. The situation is not the same. And I understand that the first principle for many people in investing, and a very good principle, is buy when blood is running in the streets. In other words, buy what nobody else wants. Buy when something is in disfavor, and a lot of things are in disfavor today. But that principle presupposes that when you buy something that has been beaten down in price by pessimism and a lack of confidence into where everybody says that thing is not rising again, it presupposes that when you buy that thing, you are selling something else that everybody wants to get his hands on now, that everybody thinks is the hot investment and therefore has run it up five or six times over and it's time to get out. There are a lot of things that might be at their bottoms. There are a lot of things that are in disfavor today. There are a lot of things that people are pessimistic about, but I am hard put to find anything that wild speculation, that wild orgies have taken to unsustainable peaks. Where is the investment today that could be at its peak? I know of nothing. I know of no investments that are at their peaks. Real estate has obviously peaked in general a year or two ago. Stocks didn't have any bull market to peak. Bonds didn't have any bull market to speak of to peak. What else is there? Commodities are in a bear market. Not only is nothing in a bull market, but most things aren't in any trend at all. Gold is clearly in a bear market right now until the price turns around and demonstrates otherwise. Most or many commodities are in bear markets right now. But when you go beyond those, you do not find clear trends. The Dow appears to be in a bear market now, and by Dow theory would be said to be in a bear market, but it certainly is no panic-stricken, crisis-ridden bear market. Bonds are just out in limbo someplace in one great trading range. Currencies against the dollar are neither strong nor weak. I've heard the expression over the last few days that the dollar is strong right now. The dollar is not really strong right now. The dollar just is not falling. The dollar seems strong to some people because they expected it to be falling right now, and it isn't. But it isn't rising either. Against the Swiss franc, for example, it is just stuck in a trading range between 180 and about 193. And it's going back and forth. And I suspect that when it finally breaks out of that range, one way or the other, it's not going very far in whichever direction it breaks out. Maybe up to 2 or maybe down to 170 or something. But currencies, the major currencies, are not in definable trends right now. We are in a very strange situation. At the end of that portfolio article in the course book is a graph. And that graph was created from a balanced long-term portfolio. As a result, it is something like, and I use this very loosely, it is something like a proxy for the whole investment world. In other words, it shows you, to a certain extent, whether the markets are receptive to investments. Necessarily switching from one to another, but in a balanced portfolio because of the kind of leverage that I described before, the chances are usually great that the investments that are going up are producing greater gains than the investments that are going down. As a result, that graph at the end of the article shows not a straight line, but a continuous uptrend from 1970 until the beginning of 1980. For 10 years, with just minor slowdowns along the way and a few backtracks for 6 months or so, the investment markets as a whole, in effect, were plotting ever onward and upward, either quickly or slowly. At 1980, that reached a peak, and then there was a sharp fall, simply because the fall in gold and the fall in silver were so great that despite the fact that they had a small percentage of the portfolio overall, they were able to affect the portfolio greatly, especially since stocks and bonds were both dropping at the same time. And in fact, foreign currencies were dropping, so in fact, there was nothing to offset it. And that
Am I on? Well, we've had a lot of fun here today while I played with the microphone, and I forgot where I was. I'm afraid I'm going to have to go back to the beginning and start over. Fellow introduced me as a man who made $1 million in the... the portfolio that started falling in 1980, it recovered and now it has leveled off. But, of course, to me what this indicates is that the markets are not nearly as orderly as they were in the 70s, because during the 70s, one thing may be going up or going down, but there was a trend. It was in a bull market or a bear market most of the time, and only for very short periods of time in a sideways market, maybe 2 or 3 months as a transition. What we've had, in effect, is a 2-year transition period so far, and it isn't even over yet. If I could say, because of some indication that it ended yesterday, and I could say that with certainty, then we could say, all right, this transition period lasted about 26 months, but it isn't even over yet. For all we know, it may be going on for another year or two. It isn't going to go on forever. It can't go on forever, at least as I see it. It's going to have to bust loose one way or the other into some bull markets or maybe all bear markets. Who knows? But something is going to break loose and cause the markets to reestablish themselves, but in a new way, a different way from the 70s. We are going through, I think, a transition period, much like the transition period from an individual bull to bear market, or in fact more from a bear market to a bull market, because the end of a bull market is very dramatic, whereas the end of a bear market is usually very undramatic, as a lot of unnoticeable events simply create a transition that turns the trend around and starts a price slowly upward. I think we are in that kind of a transition today, but I'm groping, and frankly groping, to try to make some sense out of what's going on. I have made small investments for the variable portfolio since getting out of gold. One or two of them have resulted in a 1 or 2% gain, but they were always stopped out before anything much happened. Others have actually lost 5 or 10% here and there. The losses over the last 2 years have not been dramatic or grotesque, but they have been cases where I, with a strategy of only trying to take advantage of the most clear-cut opportunities, have seen what always in the past appeared to be those clear-cut opportunities, and instead of missing one of them now and then, or to put it better, finding that one of them was not the opportunity expected to be, what I'm finding is nothing but a series of false breakouts, false signals, all the indicators that one relied on before just are wishy-washy, do not seem to be performing any service at all. And I don't know really offhand how long ago, 6 months or 9 months ago, I really started pulling back and thinking that it is better to wait this out. And that feeling has been growing over the last 6 or 9 months. And now what might be called a recommended portfolio in my newsletter, really isn't recommended, just suggested, a series of suggestions, is all in Treasury bills, 100% in Treasury bills. I would not be amazed if it stays that way for the rest of 1982. I am not predicting that any more than I would predict something else. And I won't be amazed if it stays that way through 1983. I don't know, but I'm prepared for that possibility. Because 10 years from now, if I look back and say, God, I missed the bottom of the pork belly market. All I got in 1982 was 10-12% in Treasury bill interest, when if I had been sharp, I could have made 40-50-80% in pork bellies. I'm not going to give it a thought. I'm going to have forgotten what I made in 1982. But if I look back 10 years from now and I lost 30% this year by trying here and losing 5 or 10%, trying there and losing 5 or 10%, even with a very cautious cut-your-loss philosophy, which is my way of doing things all the way, get out when the market has proven me wrong. But even with that cautious philosophy, building up a loss of 25 or 30%, I will remember that 10 years from now, because it will shrink the base on which I can make profits when the time comes where it will be much easier to make profits. There is an old salesman's expression. If you have ever sold for a living, in any office in which you worked, there was a big sign on the wall that said, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. My motto is just the opposite. When the going gets tough, the tough take a vacation. The time to work 60 hours a week, 80 hours a week, the time to be furious with activity is when every hour of that activity pays off handsomely. That's the time to reap all the profits, to just get to work and make all that money that's being thrown at you. When things are slow and your hourly wage is $2 instead of $20, that's when you should take a vacation. That's when you should just go away and we hope that you have put away some of that $20 an hour you earned during better times. I think in the same sense, that's where we are in the investment markets. It isn't impossible to make profits this year. There are people who are going to make them. There are people who have made them, perhaps largely shorting commodities, or including gold. but you're going to have to work very, very hard to get them, and they are not going to be as big as they were when things were in definable trends and you could just latch onto a gold or silver or stock bull market and ride it up and get out somewhere before or after the top. It is not going to be simple. It is not going to be easy, and the risks are going to be higher because I think the odds are against you. I think where you might have been right one out of three times before, or maybe even one out of two times, which by cutting your losses and letting your profits run, which in either case would create a big profit for you overall, I think now you'll be right one out of four times or one out of five times. And that change in the odds is simply going to mean that when you do catch a good one, it isn't going to pay for as many losses as it did before, and it isn't going to be as big a profit because it isn't a clearly defined trend. It isn't going to be as big a profit to warrant the time and effort that you're putting in and the risk you're taking. Remember, when you invest, you could make 12% in treasury bills at the present time, some comparable rate at other times. When you invest, you can get that doing virtually nothing. You don't have to subscribe to 30 newsletters and let them pile up in the corner and make you feel guilty for not reading them. You don't have to trek halfway around the world to investment seminars just to have a good place to sleep. You don't have to do any of these things when you just invest in treasury bills and you get 20%. Therefore, if you're going to have a variable portfolio, and that's a choice you make just like everything else, for many people having 100% in the permanent portfolio is eminently sensible. But if you are going to have a variable portfolio, and you are going to subscribe to all these letters and get all the inputs you can and work at it very hard and take a lot of risk coming up with a loss at the end of the year instead of a gain, then first of all, you better at least equal the 12% that you could get in treasury bills. Second, you better show a profit that pays for all of these newsletters, a profit on top of the 12% that pays for all the newsletters and the investment seminars, aside from whatever entertainment value they give you, and a lot of them are very entertaining, and on top of that, that warrants the mental depreciation that takes place as you worry about the investments, and that every morning at breakfast you have to explain to your wife why you put all that money in pork bellies, as you patiently try to explain to her the fact that the pork bellies have gone down so much in price that I'm far better off than I was before because there are far more pigs working on my behalf now than there were before. Now, that there may be understanding and reason behind that, but it isn't always so easy to explain to someone else. And the point is, of course, that if you can get 12% doing nothing, then why would anybody take risks, speculate, spend all this time, unless it's pure entertainment, which for some people it is, and I think that's a valid motivation. But why do all these things unless you're going to show a return of 30 or 40% a year? The only way to do that, I think, is by investing when the potential result is 5 or 10 times what you've identified as the potential loss, the point at which you will get out because the market has said something significant to you about a decline. Now, that, of course, is a whole other subject, the subject of picking those 5 or 10 time winning investments. As a result, the strategy you finally light on and the investment composition you finally select is bound to be different from mine, and it's bound to be different from everyone else in the audience and everyone who's been on this stage. It has to be if it's going to make sense, because making money is not the whole object of life. In fact, it isn't even an object of life. It is a means. It is a means to security. It is a means to the purchase of things that you want to actually consume, not hold. And if you have to pay a horrendous toll in mental depreciation, then you're not going to be in a position to enjoy those things. The security, the well-being, the relaxation, the comfort is as important while you're making the money as it is afterward. And you are only going to have those things if you create it yourself. You will have to work it out. I suspect that you will, no matter what others tell you. And whatever you light on, I certainly wish you the very best. Thank you very much.